Thank you. I'm going to be talking about axonal and dendritic arbors today. And I think actually Claire made a mistake that she thought I was working on tree arbors. And she invited me, but then she was embarrassed to uninvite me. So what I'm going to do is the talk is going to have two parts. The first part, I'm just going to give the background on the blackboard, and in the second part, I'll show you data. And I'm going to erase this so I don't have to worry about it, so I can start over here. Okay, the first thing I want to do is talk about the organization of the brain. And one of the most important organizing principles about the organization of the brain is that it is broken up into special parts, each one separate, that have special functions. So here is a bad drawing of a human brain looking at from the side. It looks sort of like that. This is the front and this is the back. And this is the temporal lobe, the frontal lobe, occipital lobe, and so forth. And if you and this can be divided up into a bunch of regions. So there's a region here, and all of this part of the cortex, the top, is what you look at when you see the brain, is and this is actually folded in. This is a part of the brain called V1, and around that, here is another part, which is called V2. And around that is another part, which is called V3. Up here is a region called S1. Over here is a region called M1. And I'm going to stop now, but there, if you keep going, you get about 100 of these things. As an example, all of the information that comes in from your eye goes, first of all, to V1. Then V1 processes that information, sends it to V2. V2 processes the information and sends it other places, but also to V3. And so there's this hierarchy of processing. And this is what's called localization of function. And it's been known for a long time. And it's the basis of having selective defects when you have selective locations damaged. If you kill cells at random, you can kill 30-40% of the cells in the brain, and it degrades gracefully. We've had presidents who probably had only 3/4 of the cells in their brain, but they still functioned at a pretty high level. compared to a computer, if you take out a quarter of the gates in there, you wouldn't get anywhere, because our brains are designed to be fault tolerant. And some of these things are extremely specific. So, for example, there's a region down here. This is called inferotemporal cortex. And if you have lesions there on both sides, you have a condition called prosopagnosia, which means that you can't recognize faces. Faces are incredibly important to us socially, and we devote quite a bit of surface area of the brain for processing face information. And if you have a lesion here, you can tell it's a face, no problem with knowing it's a face. You can tell where the eyes are and the nose is. You can tell if it's a happy face or a sad face, but you can't tell whose face it is. You just can't tell them apart. It's sort of like us looking at dog faces. And they all look the same. And if they have some distinctive thing, like if it has glasses on, then that would be okay. It's even your own face, you can't tell. Okay, so this is an example of the doctrine of localization of function. Yeah.
These V1, V2, etc. areas, when they were first identified, it was just on the basis of local cell morphology or connectivity?
Yes. So right around the same time, Einstein was doing special theory of relativity. A guy named Brodmann was looking at histological sections through the brain, and in the first part of the localization of function came when they noticed that there were particular lesions of the brain associated with particular functions. Like if you M1 is a motor area, so if you have lesions up here, you can't move. And if you have lesions back here, you're blind. And that's, they've known that for a long time. What Brodmann did is he went through and looked at what's called cytoarchitecture, and it very subtle differences. Somebody who's not extremely practiced doesn't have a chance to tell these things apart. V1 you can tell, there's something called the stripe of Jannary there. So anybody you point it to them once, they can always tell exactly where V1 is. More recent, so Brodmann made this map like around 100 areas. More recently, some of the areas have been subdivided, and now they have functional imaging. And the functional imaging will if you tell someone to do a visual task, you can light this up. And in fact, there's even a finer structure that I'll talk a little bit about later. Allen, the guy who founded Microsoft with Bill Gates, started something called the Allen Brain Institute. And what they're doing with mice is they are doing what's called in situ hybridization, so they can find which genes are expressed in which parts of the brain. And there are specific genes that identify specific brain areas. So probably every one of these areas you can identify by a particular combination of genes. And actually I have a graduate student who is doing a little project, this is a thesis project, to take the Allen Brain Institute and find out which genes and gene combinations are expressed to define each of the areas. That's been done to some extent by Allen, but nobody, by the Allen Brain Institute, but nobody has done it completely yet. Okay, so now each one of these areas is believed to have a map. And I'm going to go to a simpler situation, which is in principle the same as this, but it's just a simpler to talk about, and that is the fish visual system. The fish has an eye here, and you're looking down into the fish's eye. He has a photoreceptor surface that makes a hemisphere like that, and it detects light, and it sends information back to another structure in the brain called the tectum. And this is the retina. And this is where the photoreceptors are. There's a layer there's about six layers in the tectum, in the retina, depending on how you count. And one of them on the surface is the photoreceptor layer, and the light activates molecules there. They absorb photons. They cause a change in voltage. That change in voltage is so you represent the world in terms of a voltage displayed across the retina. There's if you shine a light, if the fish looks at a light, he'll see a point right there, and the only place the light is there, so I guess encoded in by the photoreceptors. The photoreceptors send the information down to a bunch of cells called ganglion cells, and those ganglion cells send information to the tectum. The tectum then gets all of the information, it goes some other places, but mainly the tectum gets all of the information from the retina, and the information that goes from here to here always goes over retinal ganglion cells. RGC stands for retinal ganglion cell, and the retinal ganglion cells send the information over here, and then this processes the information and sends it other places. Okay, so I'm going to draw a square retina because it's easier. So here is the retina, and here is the tectum, and the tectum is really a sort of three-dimensional structure. It's big, but it also has some thickness. And if the fish looks at the letter A, and this is medial, lateral, dorsal, ventral, then the letter A gets projected onto the tectum. So there's what's called a retinotopic map from retina to tectum. There's a retinotopic map from your eye to your V1. There's another retinotopic map in V2. There's another retinotopic map in V3. And there are about 36 visual areas, three dozen visual areas altogether. And each of those has a retinotopic map in it. So neighbor relations in the world are maintained in all of these visual areas. We don't know in some of these areas what the maps are, but there is evidence that every region has a map. The evidence for that outside of the visual system where you can know really what's going on and other places is the fact that when you have each cortical area up here sends information to about 10 other cortical areas, receives information from about 10 cortical areas. So the information is being exchanged, and that information is mapped in an orderly way from one area to the next. So even if you're not quite sure what the map is, if you just take any two areas that are connected, you can see that there's an orderly map where one part here, one point here goes to a point there, a point here goes to a point there. So it's believed there's a map every place. Now, in the retina, you have a photoreceptor layer that turns the light intensity and color into an electrical signal. That electrical signal gets ultimately sent down to the what's called the ganglion cell layer, where the retinal ganglion cells are, and there will be a retinal ganglion cell right here that makes a pixel, and the retinal ganglion cell looks like this. It has a cell body where the nucleus is and all the DNA is and stuff, and then sticking out from it are a lot of little tubes called processes. In this case, they're dendrites. They're very thin. They look like this, and I'll show you pictures of them later. And so the photoreceptors that are over here send their information down to that, and this samples the information. And if you draw a convex hull around this thing like that, this is a pixel, because it's sampling information from a part of a particular part of the world. This samples information from hundreds or thousands of photoreceptors. The information is sent from the photoreceptors, from a cell in between called a bipolar cell, to these retinal ganglion cells. And And so they're sampling the information. At each point in the retina, it's covered by about 1 to 2 dozen different classes of retinal ganglion cells. So actually, the way the retina is there are all superimposed about 1 to 2 dozen retinas, each of which is specialized for different functions. For example, for detecting rapid changes in light, detecting slow changes in light, having a big area so it's coarse, having a small area so it's fine resolution, having different colors associated with them. Some retinal ganglion cells are specialized for detecting certain colors, pairs of colors, other ones other pairs like that. And so there are actually a dozen retinas, and each one of those retinas then, and this is it's a pixel, because they cover, each type of ganglion cell tiles the entire retina like this. And each one of those sends information back to a particular region on the tectum, like that. And the region that this is gathering information from is called its territory. And this cell then has another kind of thing. These are dendrites. Has another kind of tube coming out from it called an axon, which is specialized for sending information over long distances. And so it goes back over here, and going from here over to the tectum it depends on the size of the fish, but the size of the fish, if it's a good-sized fish, it would be maybe a centimeter. In you, the longest axons are about a yard long, because those are the ones that go from the small of your back down to your toe. In a giraffe, the longest axons are axons in the vagus nerve, which goes from the base of the skull in the giraffe down to the giraffe's tummy. So they're 20 feet long or something. And there's just one axon the whole length. Okay, this axon goes over here, and then it forms an arbor. This is called a dendritic arbor because it looks like a tree. And then over here, another arbor is formed, which is called an axonal arbor. And it looks like this. It's highly branched. And you can draw a convex hull around this, and that is its territory, and its job is to take information from this pixel and distribute it over a region in the map, right, like this. So the cells, a pixel here gets mapped to a kind of distribution pixel over there. One down here gets mapped to a distribution pixel here. One here gets mapped to a distribution pixel here. And one over here gets mapped to a distribution pixel there. And so there's an orderly map between them. Now, if you take a region here, like this, I drew a square pixel, you can draw lines down to the bottom of the tectum, like that, and there's a whole column of cells there, and those cells are all doing various kinds of processing on the image, on a part of the image, say, right around here. And so all the cells in this region here are looking at information that was distributed by the retina to this region, or they're also looking at information from other cells in the tectum that get distributed there. So you're correlating across the image and things like that. Okay, so basically then, this is the design of the whole brain. In the cortex, there's six layers, and there's cells in each layer. The cells, those cells are born before you're born, all of them, but except for certain parts of the brain. But those cells, once they're born, they know who they are. But when you're born, you don't have, you have hardly any synapses. And the synapses are what make the connections between axon arbors and the dendritic arbors that are sampling those. And so when a mouse is born, it has just about no synapses in this cortex. It has all the cells there, and then after the mouse is born, the circuits get made by the synapses forming. There are parts of the brain where the synapses have already formed, because otherwise the little mouse wouldn't be able to breathe and suck and suckle and things like that, so it wouldn't live. In humans, I think maybe, I can't quite remember, about 20% of the synapses are made in the cortex when the human is born. And so the reason that a newborn baby is just a vegetable that only has a couple of reflexes is because it doesn't have any neural circuits in its cortex, and every second it's making billions of synapses, and over the course of development up through teenage years, you go through a period when you make more and more and more synapses, and I can't remember the age at which you get the maximum number of synapses, maybe 6 or 8 years old or something like that, and then they get pruned away over time. So the number of synapses in a human brain starts low, goes up to a peak, and overshoots, and then comes back down. Okay, so so all the neural circuits are doing exactly the same thing. They all have a map. They all are distributing information with axons, sampling information locally with dendrites, processing the information, and sending it to other places. In the human, in the mammalian cortex, which is the covering for the brain, it's about on the order of a millimeter thick and about this big total. If you took this total surface area of the human brain and spread it out, it would be sort of like this big by that big, you know, maybe a foot and a half by a foot and a half, something like that, and about a millimeter thick. And it has, and in every microliter of the cortex, there are 10 to the ninth synapses, 10 to the fifth neurons, and 10 to the ninth times 10 to the 10 to the, well, let's say 10 to the minus, okay, about 3 times 10 to the minus 6 meters of axons. So this is 10. This is a million, 3 million meters of axons in a cubic milliliter, which is how many kilometers is that anyway? What's that?
Is that microns or what?
It's about every synapse requires about 3 or 4 microns of axon.
Okay.
And so if you know the number of synapses, which is a billion, and you multiply it by the number of microns for every synapse, that gives you what it is. And this is a couple of kilometers. I can't quite remember. You guys can figure it out. Anyway, it's enormously complicated. It has to grow that way after you're born. The cells are all there, they're all in place, but then they start making their axonal arbors and their dendritic arbors. And I've been talking about two dimensions because it's easier to draw, but really they're in three dimensions. These are not. The retinal cells and the tectal arbors are flat. They're like pancakes. You'll see a picture later of one. But the ones in the cortex are three-dimensional and quite complicated. Okay.
Is the tectum in region V1?
No, the fish doesn't have a cortex. And so we have the same region, but then we've added on a cortex. But the principle is the same. I just did it because it was real simpler to draw and talk about.
But in our V1, then there's a sort of three-dimensional structure of these.
Actually, it's two-dimensional. It's a two-dimensional map of the world, but there is processing of the information from one pixel in the world that goes like that.
All right, and then the information gets sent to V2 out of these.
V1, right. All the every bit of visual information that goes to the cortex goes to V1 first, and then it goes from there to other places. Yeah, Boris.
How do these axonal arbors interact? Do they see each other?
The axonal arbors, by and large, you know, everything you say there are exceptions to and special cases and stuff, but by and large, the axonal arbors only interact by taking up space. There's no functional interactions between them. All of the functional interactions are dendrites are receiving information that's spread over a region by axons, and axons are spreading that information over a region of a map. But the axons themselves don't interact. It always goes axons to dendrites. The dendrites get all the information from a region, sum it up, process it with the cell body, send it out over the axon to the axon arbor where it gets redistributed.
I guess maybe what I'm trying to ask is, so if you take, say, you label two ganglion cells, and so that you see axon arbors, right? And then you ask, what's the probability of those two hulls to overlap?
Oh, well, if you have one cell type, one type of ganglion cell here, then the ganglion cell, these pixels are a little different from CCD camera pixels, because if I have one ganglion cell here, and it looks like this, and then I have another ganglion cell over here, it will overlap this ganglion cell a tiny bit. There's a standard distance between here and here, and there's a certain amount of overlap. And if you look at the distribution of synapses here, distribution of branches here, it looks sort of like this. And if you look over here, it looks sort of like that. So even in the retina, the pixels overlap a little bit, and then the axon arbor territories also overlap for one type of retinal ganglion cell. They'll overlap a certain amount, but there are a dozen types of ganglion cells that are overlapping here, and all dozen types will overlap in the tectum.
So how does one, at what stage does one realize it's an A rather than just a seven dots that look like an A?
It's not in V1. It's not in V2. It's not in V3. It's not in V4. It's someplace down here.
And then, in some sense, then the various axon armors are talking to each other?
No, they're talking to each other through the cells that process the information. So if you have two overlapping cells here, the signals from this one and that one are sent someplace else. The cells there are sampling it, and different sets of cells are doing that, and so they can interact and find out how much overlap there is when they process it.
But when we recognize sort of macroscopic features, we're correlating things somehow.
Yes, that's right. So in V1, for example, there is no recognition of objects. There is only recognitions of features of objects. So V1 decomposes the image into it samples the image from the retina in a way so that the cells in V1 know what tangent line in the image was passing through and what the orientation was and where it was. So it's kind of a complicated, and I can talk about that because a lot is known about V1, but I was going to talk about other stuff today. Okay, actually the data are not going to take very long, but this part is going to be is the longest part. Okay, now here's the question. If you look at any two arbors, there are no two arbors in the brain that look the same. They look roughly the same, but if you look at these pixels over here, some are round, some are elongated that way, some are elongated that way, and there are a lot of different shapes.
How do you know this? Have you analyzed all the arbors?
I haven't personally analyzed all the arbors, but there's an industry that does this.
Yeah, but they're still like 10 to the 15 or...
In the retina, there are certain types of cells that you can label because you know it from their gene expression. So that's how you know that they tile the retina. There are many types, and you know what shapes those individual arbors are, and so you can see exactly. And in fact, there's a guy at Salk named E.J. Chichilinsky who records from every ganglion cell in a patch of primate retina. He has lots and lots of electrodes. He puts the retina down on this bed of nail electrodes, and he shines lights on these things and records from all of the cells at once. It's a technically difficult thing, but you can do it. And then he can go back and stain those cell types and reconstruct them.
It's still an incredibly small subset of the cells, right?
No, in his case, he can look at essentially every cell of a particular type. Every single one.
In a certain patch of the retina.
It's extracellular recordings from just a big region of things. I mean, in most places you can't do that, obviously, but in the retina you can. You can look at every single, you can identify the behavior of every single cell in this tiling mosaic. Yeah. Okay, anyway, so, and in 3D, the arbors are quite complicated. I mean, they're big, and they stretch in lots of directions. There are two ways that people have looked at arbors. And the talk is going to be about arbors and what shape they are, basically. What I'm going to argue is that if you look at arbors the right way, every arbor in the brain is the same as every other arbor. That's going to be my final argument, that if looking at them the right way, everyone is going to be the same, that they're all the same, and that's just what you'd want. Okay, but that's a while, that's down the road a bit. Okay, now, if you... one point of view is the following, and this is maybe what a lot of people just don't think about it, but a lot of people that have thought about it would believe this. Maybe not so many more, but quite a few would. Here comes an axon arbor, and it's making it's distributing information over this distribution pixel. And here is a dendritic arbor that is going across it like that. And right here, there is a synapse. So this is the sending cell, this is a branch of the arbor of the receiving cell, and they make one contact at that point. Now, in a microliter of cortex, there are a billion of those points. Telephone network was what was used as a model for the brain. People like to believe that that the circuit required that cell A send information to cell B at that point. That every single detail, all billion synapses in a microliter, are exactly where they need to be. And so if you believe that, what you would do is you would say, well, I've got to characterize these arbors. And how would I characterize them? I would characterize them in terms of statistics, of how long each branch is, how many orders of branching out there is from the cell body, what the distribution of lengths of branches is, what the distribution of branching angles is. And if you believed that the details of the arbor made a difference, and this would be the extreme case of that, then that would be the way to go. There's an alternative way of looking at it, which is the more modern way, and that is that it doesn't matter if you put this branch here and this synapse there, or you put it over there, and this cell happens to make another branch and makes a synapse over there. It doesn't matter for that. The exact detail where everything is doesn't matter. What really matters is that you're distributing information over this region of the map in some orderly way, and you have to figure out how the brain is going to do that, because it's got to develop it. It's got to make all these circuits after the cells are all in place.
So,
yes.
You said that the synapses aren't really formed when you're born, but are these arbors formed?
The arbors are not formed, no. The arbors are not formed when the mouse is born. Some of them are, but basically not. So all of these things grow after the cortex is all set. Every cell the mouse is ever, every neuron the mouse is ever going to have is right there, and then they start growing these circuits. Okay, here's another way of looking at it, and that is, it doesn't really why is it that President Reagan could function at a pretty high level with only 3/4 of his neurons? The reason was because there is a lot of fault tolerance built into the design of the brain. So insects, for example, use one strategy, and that is they make it as fault tolerant as they can, but they usually have one nerve cell that does one job, and they make a lot of copies, and they count on their DNA getting through by swamping the environment with many copies. They kill a lot of them, doesn't matter, as long as some get through. The bigger animals like us, the mammals, what they do is, the vertebrates in general, what they do is they take another strategy, and that is they only make a few copies, but they want to make every copy as fault tolerant as they possibly can. So you can, and the way you do that is, the way you make a brain fault tolerant is, you've just got to have redundancy. There's no other way of doing it. And so for every bit of information, for every region that you're processing information, there are going to be 1,000 cells that are giving basically the same information. You can take any synapse out at all, it makes no difference. Any one synapse has a trivial effect on each neuron has 10 to the fourth synapses per neuron. And in general, all 10 to the fourth are from different cells. There are some cells that make 5 or 10 synapses, but in general, the bulk of the synapses are coming from different cells. So a lot of those cells are carrying the same information, and so you can kill any synapse, makes no difference, because you still have 999 other ones that are carrying essentially the same information. From that point of view, what matters is not exactly where you put your dendrites and your axons. It has to do with the way they're distributed over space for doing the sampling. And what you can do for that is you can take an axon arbor like this, and you put a grid on it. And I'll show you a picture of one of these in a minute. And then you count the length, you add up in every grid box the total length of the arbor in that. And I'll just do a section through the 3D arbor. This would be length, and this is length here, and this is position. Grid box, and you have it would look up, you have a histogram that looks sort of like this. Or maybe you wouldn't. You might have one that looks something else, but I just draw this one. Okay, you have some sort of histogram there. What really matters is that the shape of this histogram and where each arbor distributes its information. Cell B here won't contact cell C. There's another cell over here. It won't touch it. It doesn't like it. However, it will touch. If it touches cell A, if it has a chance, it'll make a synapse with cell A. And so if cell B and cell A are matched, so they will make synapses together, then they make it probabilistically. And so the chances that you're going to make a synapse then is, it depends on this histogram and a histogram there and how they're located in space. But it's a probabilistic view. This is this histogram here is what we call the arbor density function. And what I'm going to be talking about now is, what functional form does this arbor density function have? How many different functional forms are there for this arbor density function? And do dendrites and axons have different arbor density functions? Do each one of the 24 retinal ganglion cells have a different arbor density function? Some of them are pill boxes, and some of them are Gaussians, and some of them are something else. And I'm going to claim, no, that's not right, that actually every arbor density function is the same mathematical function describing it. Now, the people, I guess there's no neurobiologist or one neurobiologist here, know that what I just said is totally out of sync with what with the pictures of neurons they've looked at. And in fact, you can look here. I already said it. Here's a round one. This is an oval one. There's another oval one. They're not the same shape. What do you mean by the same shape? What I mean by the same shape is that they're the shape that you get only by stretching in one of three major coordinates. So you can have a function that's the same, but then you can stretch that function one way or another way. And if you do that, I'm calling that the same shape, because it's the same mathematical function. It's just been stretched. Its coordinates have been stretched. This is sort of like Somebody told me that I missed it yesterday afternoon, but somebody told me you were discussing Darwin finches' beaks, and some are long, thin beaks, and some are short, fat beaks for the seed eaters. And I think probably whoever was talking about this talked about the fact that calmodulin decides how long the beak is, and BMP4 decides how fat it is this way. And so you can change, you can stretch a beak this way and stretch it that way. And I don't actually know this because I have never studied it, but I would be willing to bet that that all of those beaks are described by the same mathematical function. It's just that you stretch the coordinates. That's a speculation. I don't know. Maybe somebody knows. Okay. How do we measure an arbor density function? Well, I just did it here. You put a grid over the arbor, and the number of synapses is what matters, is proportional to the length. And so you just make a grid and add up all the things. There it is. There's the arbor density function. But this is too crude to do anything with. Well, what do you do then? Okay, what you might do is you make the boxes smaller. That's not going to work because these arbors are so sparse that by the time you get the boxes small enough that you'll have reasonable resolution, then you won't. Then this histogram will be so jiggly you won't be able to see anything. Well, what's the usual solution? The usual solution is you take different arbors and you average them. Well, you could do that, but the trouble with that is that we don't know which arbors it's fair to average. We don't know. We could speculate that all of the arbors of one ganglion cell type were fair to average, but that may not be true. And not only that, but how do you average this arbor A with arbor B? Well, you have to stretch it or something. And how do you know that's legitimate? You don't. So what you want is you want some way of describing the shape of the arbor, that the shape of the density function that doesn't depend on the local features of the arbor. And the obvious thing to do is to use a trick from probability theory, where you can describe a probability density function by a histogram like this, or you can describe equally well a probability density function by the moments. And the moments of a probability density function are the mean, but those are all global properties. If the mean is you compress it this way and compress it that way, if it's two dimensions, and get the mean, you get the variance in this direction, the variance in that direction, you get the third moment in this direction, a fourth moment, whatever you want. And you know that basically if you have an arbor, if you have a density function, the way you get the moments is you Fourier transform it, you expand it in the power series, you take the coefficients in the power series. So you can, if you know all the moments, you can go back. In general, we don't know all the moments. But moments are global. The variance doesn't depend on where this branch is or where that branch is. It depends on where all the branches are. So moments are the way to go. So what we have done, and is Andrea Pillai, who was a graduate student who started this project with me actually about 4 years ago. And Andrea is Singaporean. She's back in Singapore now. And we started working with goldfish for a reason I won't tell you about, and we did a bunch of stuff with goldfish arbors. And then Joe Snyder, who was a graduate student with Claire, came to be a postdoc with me. And then and Joe's really good with computational things. And so there's a database that has thousands of arbors in it that have been reconstructed. And so Joe downloaded the database and got it into a format that we could do business with. And so what I'm going to be telling you about is the analysis of I don't know now how many it is, but on the order of 2,000 or 3,000 arbors. These arbors come from fish, because that's what we started with, because they're simple, they're 2D, you can do business with them easy, and you can study them easily. But then, in addition to the fish arbors, we have cortex arbors from and some other regions from mice, rats, cats, monkeys, and humans. There are different types of cells in the brain, and we have arbors from many different types, and they come from many different regions. And they're axonal arbors and dendritic arbors, and so those have all been analyzed. And now I'm gonna take this. Actually, is gonna come out even. You'll see, because the data comes very quickly at the end. So now I'm gonna describe how we analyze these arbors and what we were looking for. Okay, imagine you're trying to grow a brain. Well, how are you going to do that? It's got to be simple, because if you have to keep track of too many, there's not going to be enough information to make it work if you have to keep track of too many things. You have to keep track of the cell types you like, and we know quite a bit these days about how where the cells decide to put these arbors. There are pattern formation mechanisms, efferents, and things like that that tell them that they go to a particular place in a gradient, and they make their arbor there, and the arbors get modified. But if you're going to make an arbor, you've got to have it be simple. What's the simplest thing you can think of? The simplest thing you could think of is to have the smallest number of parameters specifying the arbor that you can imagine. If you have more parameters, that's going to get worse. So what you want to do is you want to have the arbors, you want to know what shape they are. You don't have to worry about, is it shape A or shape B? All you want to have to worry about is, I go to this place in the brain, I make my arbor a certain size, and then I know that if I contact all the other arbors I bump into of the right type, it'll all work out okay, because if you had to think about it more, you'd say, okay, well, I go to this place here because I know the center of this arbor is there, I know it's this wide, and that's all I have to worry about. So there are two things really that you want to know is simple, to make things simple. Here, there are places in the brain where the arbors for axons or dendrites are shaped like this. And if you're dendrites looking at an arbor that's shaped like this, you're looking down on the surface of the arbor. It's like I'm making your eye like it's 2D. If you're looking at it from this direction, the arbor is all spread out because it's sampling all along a line because you want to detect lines. If you're looking at this direction here, it's a line in a particular place. It's very narrow. You don't want to have to worry. You know, when you take this arbor, you started with one like this and you stretch it out. You want to stretch it out so you're sampling over a big region here, but you don't want the guys coming in this direction to know its shape has been changed, to have to worry about that. So basically what I'm saying is that you would like this arbor density function to be separable. It's not going to be perfectly separable, but as close to separable as you could get. So one thing you'd like is separability. And so that changing the arbor in one direction doesn't have a big effect on how it changes in the other direction. The second thing you would like is you'd really like to have all the arbors be the same shape. They can't be exactly the same shape because this is a circle and this is an ellipse, but at least they can be the same shape in the sense that the name of the function that describes them can change, and all you do is stretch the coordinates. If you do that, then that's been studied, and the functions that have the property of being the same shape but just stretched are called self-similar functions.
So do you have to worry about changing the density when you stretch and change the area? Do you want to keep the density?
Yes. So that's something you would have to worry about. And there's, I'm not going to talk about that, but there's a theory for that, because what you'd want to do, basically the basis of the theory is to say that you want to if you have two arbors that are the same size and make them bigger, you want to have the chances that they make a synapse between each other be the same. But I'm not going to talk about that part of it. There's going to be one empirical parameter that I come up with in the end of this. That one empirical parameter is I'm not going to talk about, but there's a theory for it. That's just a different thing. Okay, what's a self-similar function? In one dimension, a self-similar function is a function that, I'm just doing it one dimension, it's a function of position, okay, and it has a size parameter, lambda, and that function can be written as lambda to some power alpha times the function of x divided by lambda when the size parameter is 1. This is a self-similar function. What this says is that basically all the functions of the same class, the self-similarity is not a property of an individual function, it's a property of a whole family of functions. And if you change the size parameter here, that says how much you're stretching the function in this direction. And I'm doing it in a simple way that you might have another exponent down here, but this for a particular lambda that says how much you're stretching it in that direction, and this way it says how much you're stretching it in that direction. If you have one lambda, then all the functions that you stretch by a certain amount will look the same, except they're going to be stretched this way and stretched that way. In other words, every function of this class you can get back to the same form by just changing the axes in this direction and changing the axes in that direction. So that's what I mean by the same shape, that there are self-similar functions. Okay, now I said we're going to use moments, and I'm going to say what the moments are. I'm going to do things in the least number of dimensions I can, and so for arbors it's 2. And what Joe and I calculate is the first 20 moments. Why 20? Because if you calculated every single moment and looked at them, you'd actually get the actual arbor back. In other words, if you knew every single moment and you did the inverse, combined them and did the inverse Fourier transform, you just get back what you started with, because it's invertible. However, if you only take a certain number of moments, then you only look on a certain scale of the map of the arbor, and all the higher frequencies don't come in. And so if you take the first 20 moments, then you're looking at about the first 1/20th, the scale, the resolution is about 1/20th of the arbor. I mean, roughly something like that. Okay, so M subscript K is the kth moment, and you can calculate it very easily. And we use two kinds of moments, and I'm not going to, I can tell you why if you want to know, but I'll give you the final reason in just a second why we do that. And the first ones are called product moments. And you sum over all J, and here's an arbor, and I take this branch here and I look at it, and the computer program that you use for reconstructing these arbors approximates this by a bunch of short segments. Actually, you do them by a bunch of short segments. So what you do is you have a picture of the arbor there, and you just touch along all the branches. And if we look at this segment here, xj and yj is the center of that segment. The segments are all very short. And wj is the weight of that, it's the length of the segment. So what you do is you multiply xj times yj to the kth power and weight it by wj. Wj is not normalized, it's the length of a little branch, and so that means that m subscript 0 is equal to the arbor length. Now, it's sometimes useful to have normalized arbors, and mu k is equal to the normalized kth arbor, which is just mk divided by m0. That basically, you take the length and you divide it into this, and that way it's normalized so it sums to 1.
But that's only going to work if your w's are much smaller than, well, 1/20th or whatever the size of the arbor.
Oh, yes, they are. Oh, much smaller. They're really small. And we've looked into this. I mean, we checked to make sure that if you double them or something, it makes no difference. And it truly doesn't. You can do a lot of things that makes no difference. Okay, so these are the normalized moments. And we also want to have what we call separated moments. And the separated moments are m, say in the x direction, m superscript, it's not a power, it's a superscript k, and that equals the sum over j of xj to the kth power times wj. And there's one for y too. And these are also normalized, and so you could have mu subscript k x like that, and that would be m superscript x subscript k divided by m0. And one of the things that I'll use a lot is I have a special, if k happens to equal 2, this is sigma, and I'll put the x down there this time. This is just the standard deviation of the variance, and you'll see why I'm using that in a second. Okay, you can take for separability, the only function that is circularly symmetric, a lot of these arbors are close to circularly symmetric, that's circularly symmetric and separable is a Gaussian. The arbors can't have an arbor density function that's a Gaussian because they have a boundary here and they go to zero outside that. But you could say they're a truncated Gaussian, and I'll come back to that in a second. And so for separability, what you can do is you can plot mu x k times mu yk versus mu k. That is, you can look at the product of the separated moments times the product times the moment product. That is, that the moment of the products is equal to the product of the moments. And if they're separable, this on a straight line has a slope of 1. So you can test to see how far they are from separability by seeing how well they fall on this line.
Sorry, something I don't understand.
Yeah.
So if you say that they are separable when they're close to a Gaussian?
If they're close to a Gaussian, they'll be separable.
Actually, you need only the two first moments to specify who is the Gaussian.
Well, any two moments. Any two moments. Doesn't matter which two you have. Usually people use the first two because they're all related to each other. So you can take any two and then you can calculate what the other ones are.
But what I'm saying is that why is that that you use the Gaussian?
Well, because we don't know if it's a Gaussian or not.
It's close.
You'll see it's close and you'll see what I mean by that in a second. Actually, for these fish arbors, all the moments are related to, all 20.
But you would be able to show by saying, you measure the first and second moments, the mean and the standard deviation, and then you say, measure the second. If it's very close to zero, you say, okay, so it's...
Yeah, you'll see. You see, okay. So there's something that I should, I'm gonna erase a little bit of this here, and stuff over here. And that is, this is what you actually measure. This is what you think about. This is what we actually measure. This is the Arbor density function that we care about. And so if you're going to do a calculation to compare these things, this is what you have to use, but this is what you actually measure. For calculation, this is what you use if you want to do something analytically, and this is what you measure. Yeah, okay. So separability test. What you do is you measure mu xk times mu yk versus product moment k, and you look for deviations from a line that goes through zero and has a slope of one, and I'll tell you in a second what you do with that. If you take the definition of separability and you plug it into integrals like this, and you do some other manipulations that I'm not going to bother you with, you can make a two-step test for separability. I'm sorry, for self-similarity. The first step is this. You plot log of sigma x times sigma y. These are all two dimensions, but you do sigma x, sigma y, sigma z for three dimensions, versus the log of m sub k. If you do that, if you take the self-similarity and do this out, you can work out that what you get is a bunch of straight lines. And each one of these straight lines has a slope, and this would be m0, m4, for example, m20. And I'm only going to show you stuff from even numbered moments, and you can ask me about it if you want to later, but we've worried about the odd numbered moments and everything is just fine, but it's easier to just talk about the even number moment, because insofar as these things are almost symmetrical, which a lot of them are, the odd number moments vanish on average, and they do. Okay, so you get this, and the data should all fall on straight lines if it's a self-similar function. And if you take, here you plot the moment order, k is the moment order, and here you call the slope of this one here s subscript k, and you plot the slope of s subscript k versus k, then you should get a straight line with a slope of 1 and an intercept down here that's not 0, and you don't know what that is. Okay, so if you take any function in the world, you can turn it into a self-similar function. It doesn't matter what self-similar function it is. It doesn't matter what its name is. It could be an exponential. It could be something else. If you plot it this way, it has to fall on straight lines with increasing slopes. If you plot those slopes in each one of those slopes on this log plot versus k, it has to be a straight line with that doesn't go through zero but has a slope of 1, and this is just some calculations you do. And in fact, all of these things over here were defined so you this is true. Well, how do you know what function it is? If this is true for every self-similar function, what's the difference from one function to the other? And that is that every different self-similar function has a different pattern of intercepts over here. So you can take a Gaussian, you can plug it into these things, use the self-similarity, do it all out, get an analytic solution for what these intercepts are there. You can take a truncated Gaussian, truncated at any number of standard deviations out, do the calculation, and predict exactly what those intercepts are going to be over there. Okay, so...
Check.
Yes.
If for the two dimensions f of x, y, lambda is going to be lambda v alpha, f x over lambda,
yeah.
f y over lambda.
Yes.
Same scaling with respect to it.
Yeah. Okay, so part of this in developing the test was that you don't have to have lambda be the same in this direction, that direction, and that direction. They're potentially three different lambdas. Turns out that if you take the product of the lambdas and just call that lambda, even though they're different, then this is what I just said has to be true.
It would be very strange if you were making your brain and you were had preferred directions. I mean,
you do have preferred directions because you have a map there, and you have directions on the map that are related to the world. But what we actually do is this x and y are the zero of the coordinate system is the thing that makes the first moment vanish, so you don't have to subtract anything out from here. That's why there's no mean subtracted from those things, and the arbors are all rotated so that the covariance is minimum and the long axis is up and the shorter axis is that way they're just the standard that we use. Okay, so
sorry, I'm lost on the fundamental here. Just what roughly is the structure of the tree in the sense that you drew the convex hull, and I thought at the time that what you meant to say is that there is the area, and inside that area, the arbor is more or less
Gaussian,
or even dense.
It could be a constant density. I'll show you it's not, but it could be a priori. It could be a pill box.
As opposed to, in fact, some self-similar structure with algebraic.
Yeah. This is not self-similar in the sense that it's self-similar in a different sense, in the sense that Barenblatt uses it. Not self-similar like a
roughly,
fractal structure.
Roughly, I can sort of think of this as a uniform density with some sort of a smeared edge, perhaps.
The density is not uniform. It can be anything in here, and these things are not fractal. The structures are not fractal, but they're self-similar in the sense that they're all generated by a function with one name, like Gaussian or exponential or pillbox or something like that. Okay, so let's look at some data quickly. Okay, this is supposed to go on now. Okay, so it's warming up. Is there a way of turning those lights off?
Yes.
You can probably see it without. The slides are clear. Okay, this is an actual axon. This is an actual arbor. There's the cell body. There are two arbors. This is a pyramidal cell. This is a dendritic arbor going down this way. That's called the basal arbor. And there's another arbor going that way. This is called an apical arbor. This is a projection. And so in 3D, it looks a little bit different from this. And we treat this arbor and this arbor as distinct arbors. This is an axonal arbor, and you can see it's being spread around here. This is also this arbor is also distorted from the fact that it was reconstructed from a single section, and so there are branches that are sticking out that you can't see. I have to find something to change this with. This looks like PowerPoint, but it's not. Okay, here's a picture of the brain. that I drew before, and those are all Brobman's areas on there. So you can see, you can just see what they look like. You can see the very back, the red one is V1, and the next kind of black one is V2, and the next yellow one is V3, and it's all every part of the brain is part of that. Okay. This is an actual arbor. This is a fish retinotectal arbor that was filled in a particular way with something called dye eye. So this is just one arbor, and here is the same different arbor that is plotted down here on a flat plane, and then this grid was laid on it, and this is the density function that arbor would have, and you can see that this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This is 6 by 6, a 6 by 6 grid. But you can see if you started making the grid very sparse, you start having big holes in here. So it would be too sparse to see anything. Okay, here's the test for separability. And on here are the first 20 moments of fish axon arbors and dendritic arbors. This line here is a slope of 1, and there are 2,000 data points on this slide, and so it actually is better than it looks because most of the data points are obscuring other data points. And this down here is the slope of the line for each arbor. This is the distribution of slopes. It should be around 1. And if it's around 1, and these are dendrites and those are axons, and this is 0.9. So they're close to 1. Okay, I'll just this line here is the best fitting a line overall, and there are a couple of tests that we've used for separability, and this line here is what you would get if you had an arbor that was truncated at about 2, it was a Gaussian truncated at about 2 standard deviations out, and you'd have a line down about here if it was a pillbox, in other words, a uniform density. Okay, this is an example of a family of functions, which are Gaussians, that are self-similar and not self-similar. This is a family of self-similar Gaussians, and this is the family of non-self-similar Gaussians. And you can't tell by looking which one is self-similar and which one isn't. But if you plot the log of the second moment normalized here versus the log of the unnormalized moments, for the self-similar one, you get these slopes here. And for the non-self-similar one, you get these slopes here. You get these things here that curves up. And the function, and the function that was used was the following one. F of x equals e to the alpha e to the alpha, my goodness. I usually turn it flat like that, and I'm having trouble I didn't bother to turn it. Log lambda to the p power e to the minus x squared over 2 lambda squared. Okay, that's the function that's being plotted here. This function is self-similar for p equals 0 and p equals 1, and for anything else it's not self-similar. And the reason is, in order to be self-similar, it has to be a power function here, which is something you can show. And this is a power function in front of lambda when p equals 0. zero, it's p to the lambda to the zero, and p equal one is lambda to the alpha, but p for anything else is not. Okay, so these this function here is p to lambda equals one, and this and these functions here are p to the lambda equals, I can't remember, two or three.
So can I ask you something? You see that this function is self-similar in the sense actually that it's a scaling function?
It's this function, this function here, f of x and lambda. I forgot to put lambda there.
What I'm saying is that if you put f of x lambda, now imagine if we scale x with a constant, positive real. Okay, just multiply by alpha and positive real.
Yeah.
I cannot. This is not a scaling function. It's not a function that you define. Yeah. You're going to take it out. You're going to take it off as a constant.
I'm sorry. This is a function of. This is a function of x and lambda. Lambda is my size scale, and x is my x variable. This function is not a self-similar function because as you change lambda, you don't have a power function sitting in front here. And you can, so a way of thinking of self-similar functions is to imagine you have a transformation, and what that transformation does is it operates on the it's a operator. That operator operates on a function, and it divides the it changes the two scales. In order to be self-similar, that operator has to be a group, and in order for it to be a group, when you operate with two different lambda and a gamma in a row, then you have to get the same result as if you operated with the transformed lambda gamma. In order for that to be true, this has to be, in order to preserve that symmetry, this has to be a power function there. So we can talk about it later.
I'm just taking the definition that you use of scaling function and just applying it here.
Maybe since we're running over time,
yeah.
We'll do that later.
Yeah, okay.
Offline.
Yeah, okay. So let's get to the data here. Okay, so this is sigma x times sigma y. Those are the second moments normalized, and this is the convex hull of all of those functions. And you can see that on a log plot, they fall on a line that has a slope of one. So that means that you can either use sigma x times sigma y or the convex hull as a measure of the size of the arbor. So basically, if you plot over here the moment order versus the log of the moment versus the log of the sigma x sigma y, this is basically the size of the arbor plotted this way logarithmically, and this is all the moments, and this is one of the reasons we did it this way. Okay, these are axons and dendrites from roughly 100 axons and 100 dendrites, and you can see that they all fall on these straight lines. This is moment 0, 10, 20, even number moments. They all fall on straight lines. You can't see that they're curved at all. So you would not be able to. And these are all least squares fits, just straight ahead least squares fits. If you take the slope of each one of these lines here and you plot that versus the moment order, this is k down here and the slope, you can see they fall on a straight line. These are these error bars here are two standard deviations, confidence limits for two standard deviations, and the slope of this line is within a tenth of a percent or something like that of one, and the intercept down here is not zero but not known. If you take these intercepts here, so this says the function is a self-similar function, and there's only one function because all the axons and dendrites are put on top of each other here, and if you fit them separately, they have the same intercepts. Okay, this thing here says yes, these functions all have the same shape, except you look at them, some are stretched one way or the other. You look at all these intercepts here, and you plot the intercept on the log plot versus the moment order, and you get this line here. the line that goes through these is what you would predict from a Gaussian that was truncated at two standard deviations. What you would get here is a Gaussian that is truncated at three standard deviations, and down here is what you would get if you used a Gaussian that was truncated or at one standard deviation. Okay, so the conclusion is that the fish arbors are self-similar, and I don't know what the real function is, but they're adequately fitted by a truncated Gaussian, truncated at two standard deviations, but not three or one.
So how many arbors? So how many neurons do you use to calculate one of the probability density functions?
Every neuron gives us 20 moments. Every neuron is plotted on the plot there. Every moment from every neuron is plotted on that plot. There are 20 moments.
So for one neuron, you calculate all the moments?
Yes. Every neuron, you calculate every moment.
That's 6 for C3.
No grid. Calculate the moments the way I did with the equations over there. Like if you imagine it's a wire frame, and you want to calculate the moments of inertia, you calculate it sort of like that. Okay, this is the test for separability for about 2,000. So there are about 20,000 data points on here, and this is the test of separability for arbors that I told you about from a bunch of fish, and. This is the last thing, Claire, I'm done. And these are the 3D arbors, and you can see that this is the 20th moment, 10th moment, 0th moment. They all fall in lines. They all have the same intercepts over here. If you plot the slope of the arbor, these lines versus the moment order, they fall on a straight line. The slope of the straight line is 1. It has an intercept that's not. And this is the intercepts of these arbors plotted versus the moment order. These are the data here. These lines here is a 3D arbor truncated at two standard deviations. This is at three standard deviations, and this is at one standard deviation. Okay, so the conclusion is that these arbors are all the same shape because they all have the same intercept, or maybe some are not exactly, but pretty close, and that they have this property of self-similarity, which means they all have the same function except stretched one way or the other, and that function is, as far as we can tell, close to a Gaussian. Okay.
What animals?
These are humans, rats, mice, cats, different cortical areas, everything, yeah. Okay, I'm sorry I ran over. That's very bad. There's one alpha total, and it's the only. So let me just. We'll get a curve to look at here. Okay, these are the mammalian moments, and alpha is determined by this intercept here. So if you know that, so the question of whether they're all the same shape or not, all that means is all the arbors intercept at the same places over here. It doesn't matter where they are, as long as the dendrites and the axons say both go to the same point here, then they all have to have the same density function. Okay, once you know that, then you know that slope of every one of these has to the slope of every one of these is a particular number that's given by this up here, and there's one thing that you don't know, and that is this intercept here or the slope of this line here. And the slope of this line here is this is the zeroth moment, and so this is the length of the plot of the length of the arbor versus the size of the arbor. That's what this line basically is, and so if you're given that, and you're given these numbers over here, then there's nothing else to know. These numbers over here tell you what the name of the function is, and then this number here is the only other one that lets you predict every moment.
Is it zero?
And it's not zero. It's about 0.5.
Okay, so just to tell people what's going on, we've rescheduled Victor Luria's talk to be Friday, the second talk, because BJ had to cancel. So we're putting to allow Victor to have a decent amount of time, and so we're going to let Chuck just answer questions on his talk, and then we'll be done for the day.
Good. Is that okay? Yeah. Yes.
You answered it already. So here you're saying that for different organisms, since you're plotting different organisms on the same plot, they have the same density function.
Yes.
Independent of
mammals and fish.
Oh, it's mammals and fish, and they have the same density.
Except for 2D. The 2D arbors are 2D Gaussian. The 3D arbors are 3D Gaussian. These are all mammals, and they are all plotted, all have 3D arbors. But there are some 2D arbors, and those 2D arbors in mammals are, as far as we can tell, the same as the 2D arbors in fish.
And what is the function?
It's a Gaussian.
Yeah, truncated Gaussian.
At two standard deviations out, right around.
So in that function, where does the alpha show up? Is it part of the truncation?
No. The alpha shows up with basically saying that it's all fitted by the same function and it's a self-similar function says that you stretch the coordinates, and then you multiply in front of that function, you stretch that too. And so that says that the alpha says how, as you make the area of the arbor bigger.
So I'm just trying to write out on a piece of paper what this function is. It's something I could write down with a truncation.
Okay, so it would be lambda to the alpha in front.
Okay.
E to the minus x squared plus y squared plus z squared over 2 lambda squared.
Right.
Inside times something that truncates it circularly.
What happens when you go to higher order moments? Yeah, it seems it works up to 20, so why not go into...
Well, the way we picked 20 was, if you look here, there are 200 there on the scale, that's 10 to the 200th power. And I was worried that if I went up too much more, there'd start being round-off errors and things like that in doing the calculations, because that's a big number.
So you could estimate the right part of this curve.
Yeah, you could, but it seemed like, you know, people who try to infer density functions from numbers of moments, you know, they usually take half a dozen moments. I don't know if anyone ever took as many as 20.
The 20 already seemed to not for me, yeah? So I was surprised about the 20.
But now why don't I do 50, right?
My energy takes a mile.
Yeah, right.
I thought it must break down somewhere on the way, but it...
Oh, it has to break down, absolutely. Because if you go to a high enough number of moments, so for this number of moments, then okay, so if you have a density function, a Gaussian, the first 20 moments will be this. If you take a Gaussian and then you put noise on top of it that's higher frequency, high enough frequency, then that will average out, and you won't see it in the first 20 moments, but if you go to a higher number of moments, then you will start seeing it. And so we did 20 worked, and it seemed like the numbers were getting so big I was worrying about round off errors and things like that, so we just stopped at 20.
What's the scale in microns? You
think microns.
Can we resolve this order with the moment of 20? Like, is it...
No. The arbors are on the order of 100 microns or 1,000 microns across, this would give us down to maybe 5 or 10 microns resolution.
And the W was that? So this Rayleigh factor, was this somehow the volume?
No. That's the length of each little branch, little segment that you use for representing the arbor. So you represent it by many segments, so that when you look at it, it looks like you capture all of the wiggles in the arbor branches, a lot of little segments, and then each one of those branch, each one of those segments has a weight, which is its length.
And it also varies in like thickness, I guess. You go away from the soma.
Yes, it doesn't vary too much. It does vary some, and we ignore that.
And something like where the synaptic inputs are is not really known for many dendrites.
The inputs in most cases are axon arbors are much bigger than dendritic arbors, and the reason is that on an axon arbor there's a synapse every 3 to 5 microns. For dendritic arbors there are 10 or 20 synapses per micron. So the way the arbors are made, and these arbors are mostly made, is the arbor goes like this, and then there's a little teeny tiny one or two micron branch sticking out that's called a spine. And those spines are arrayed in a helical way around the arbor branch, so that any axon coming from any direction gets a chance to make one of those synapses. But since you have to have the same number of synapses coming in as going out on average, then you have tenfold more. The axonal arbors are 10 times bigger.
Has it moved the angle between successive spines?
Well, I don't know. Let's see.
On average?
I can't remember. I remember the paper, but I can't, that did it. But I can't remember what it is. But there may be maybe a tenth of 2 pi radians.
Oh, okay.
What do you have? Oh, sorry.
I was curious, what's the distribution of these lambdas which you are inferring?
Oh, okay, so the lambda that I'm talking about here is if you have an actual arbor, sometimes that arbor might be expanded this way, sometimes it might be expanded that way, and we would count all the things that were expanded anyway. We take the product of the expansions this way, and that way. We take the product of those. That's what we call lambda, because that's what works out to give you this test that works. It's another question about how those lambdas, how the lambda x, lambda y, and lambda z are distributed, so there's a graduate student who is just finishing up her thesis now. One of the preoccupations has been to classify arbor shapes in the past, but people don't know exactly what to measure. if you believe this, then you can then this tells you how many parameters you have to measure in order to be able to know all the arbor shapes. And so this is what she's doing. And the best way for her to tell the strongest classification between different arbor types when she looks at the individual lambdas is the laboratory that reconstructed them. So these are all databases. All these things here came from databases on the web, and there were and the data that came there came from about a dozen different laboratories. So different people measured them. But now the database has been getting bigger, and there are several laboratories whose data points tend to fall off these lines, and those are the ones. And what happens is the reason they do is because the people who do those truncate their arbors. They draw the first 100 microns and they quit. And so that's the strongest signal in knowing which ones are which.
Is there any idea on what kind of growth process leads to this kind of distribution? Because it's like it's completely untree-like. A tree will try to fill space, supposed to be denser in the middle.
Yes.
So do you know what kind of growth process is giving these sorts of things?
Yes. Okay, so there are experiments that people have done on how arbors grow. So a guy named Stephen Smith's lab and Holly Klein, who's at UCSD now, used to be at Cold Spring Harbor, and Stephen Smith at Stanford, have both studied this. And what happens is when the arbors are growing, you know, you start out, you don't have any arbor, no synapses. Then the arbors start growing. When they start growing, they stick out branches. And if they can find enough suitable targets that they can synapse with on that branch, they stabilize it. If they can't find enough branch arbor, enough synapses that they can make with other cells, they retract it, and then they try another one. And so if you have this kind of self-avoiding random walk where you have a sea of synapses that the arbor can make, and then it starts putting out branches and trying to see if it can stabilize them, then it competes with itself locally, which accounts for part of the reason why you never have branches crossing like that. In 3D, they look like they cross sometimes, but they never do. They're always like that, but they never come close to each other, because this branch and this branch would have already used up the oxygen here, and then not literally oxygen, but whatever the signal is, also these arbors in Joe's program. Joe's the person who developed the program. Joe Snyder developed the program for this. They compete with each other. And so when all the cells around have used up the most of the synapses, then these guys have to stop growing. They can't stabilize any more branches. So if you do what I just said, you make branches, and you also have to put a little tube of repulsion around each branch that's not very big, and then you get this kind of funny self-avoiding random walk.
Except, I mean, what you just described is not dissimilar from what a tree does, and yet again the pattern's very different from trees. So
yes. For plants, for example, another thing you can do is you can say for plants, what about the venation pattern? That's a branching structure like this. So we've analyzed two things like that. Three things. We've analyzed rivers. We've analyzed wing venation patterns in insects, and we have analyzed venation patterns in leaves. And those are not like this.
No.
Because they are a boxcar, a pillbox. They branch.
They have to fill the space.
They fill the space, yeah. Because their job is to stabilize the leaf or change the mechanical properties of the wing or something like that. And they want to do it every place. So I guess the wing you could have it different. I don't know really.
And they come on straight lines like this, and then
they come on straight lines, yeah. But they fall on straight lines like this. But the intercepts over here are different.
Yeah.
So in that case, what then is the difference between these the patterns are trying to fill space and the growth of these axons and stuff?
Yeah.
Because again, what you described in growth is not dissimilar from what happens in a leaf venation or a tree.
Yeah.
So.
I don't know. I don't think we understand it well, but if you have a polymer and you look at it and see how it fills space, it fills a Gaussian. If you have a polymer that does a self-avoiding random walk where it can't cross itself because of the excluded volume, then that does not make a Gaussian. So then your run-of-the-mill self-avoiding random walk goes out of its way not to give you a Gaussian, but these are giving us Gaussians. And so there is something about this particular class of self-avoiding random walks that are giving you Gaussians, but I don't know what it is. And we haven't looked into it. I mean, you can make arbors with other rules which are not like this. In other words, it's not as if it's impossible to make something that doesn't like this. But if you do this random walk with the tube of excluded volume effectively around it, but trial stabilization with competition, so. But if you populated trees with leaves, seems like you might. Yeah, I don't know what you do in that case. You want to have them be able to get the sunlight, so you don't want them concentrated in the middle. You want them concentrated. Well, maybe you do. What do they do?
Well, they tend to fill space. They're much the same as leaf veins.
They
have rules in proximity of the secondary meristems to the primary. Mediated by plants' metabolism and space.
So, because in a tree, what you'd want to do is you don't want to have leaves on the inside; you don't get any light. You'd want to put the leaves where you shield the inside the least possible, but still get the most surface area. I've never looked into that. I don't know.
Yeah, it's simpler than that. The leaves fall off every year in a tree, and so the ones inside those meristems don't make leaves anymore. They're in the dark.
I see.
They're in the dark, and so every year you get another trial, right?
Unlike I see. So every year you fix it up better. Yeah.
And so it has to be effective at each and every year.
At every year, yeah.
Yeah. Small it still has to be effective, and so you still get this filling.
I see. That's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not.
They sense the light, and so they know whether they're in the dark or not. There's nothing in your thing.
Yeah. But it seems like what would be different is that you make it, you try it, and then you retract it and try again. That seems like that might be different from what the trees are doing.
Is the synaptic density about uniform over the arbor?
Yes. Pretty close to uniform.
It's odd that the arbor itself would be more dense in the middle if it's connecting to a random pattern of synapses, it's uniform.
Yeah. So the synapses in a volume of brain are quite uniform. They're equal every place.
And you said that the polymer case would give you a Gaussian if it was not a self-avoiding animal.
Yeah, but if
that tube was pretty narrow, so that maybe the polymer self-avoiding is bigger than the tube that you're talking about in brain, and so you might get something more like Gaussian.
Well, I haven't thought about self-avoiding random walks for a bit. Let me just think for a second. So I guess that if you made a self-avoiding random walk where the excluded volume is zero, then it would be just a regular random walk. And so if you made that tube smaller and smaller, it seems like it ought to get closer and closer. Yeah.
Right. Its only job is to prevent self-synapsing.
Yeah. Yeah. How big that tube is, the Joe's model has very few parameters in it. And I can't quite remember how many there are now, but it has very few parameters. And one of the parameters is how big that excluded volume tube is.
I mean, it seems like the branching would have an effect, right? If you couldn't branch at all, and if you wanted uniform density on the perimeter, then you would necessarily have higher density in the middle just to...
Yeah. Okay, so we could ask, why would you want a Gaussian? Why would you not want to have it be a pillbox? And there's several reasons. One of the reasons is that you'd like it to be, at least hypothetically, you'd want it to be separable, so that when you stretch in one direction, that doesn't change the other directions. So the closer to a Gaussian you are, the better that works. Our truncated Gaussians are more similar, are more separable than a pillbox would be. That's one reason. The second reason is, if you think of the retina, and you think you have all these retinal ganglion cells tiling the surface but overlapping a little bit, and if you have a point of light and you move that point of light, then every ganglion cell is reporting on the intensity it sees, and it's going back to the brain, and the brain has to figure out how bright the light is by looking at all the inputs coming in. You don't want the light to go bright and dim as it moves from one ganglion cell to the next. So you want to cover the space with your ganglion cells as smoothly as possible, so that the signal going back to the brain is as smooth as possible as you move a point of light. And what you can show is that the function if you have a lattice now with these ganglion cells on them, if there's a little bit of noise in the lattice, so sometimes they're too close, sometimes they're too far apart, then if you have a perfect lattice, you can make any function. You can make boxcar functions and exactly cover. Everything would be smooth. But if you have a little bit of noise in the lattice, if you have a lot of weight out in the tails, then where two things overlap, there's going to be a big spike, and where two things going back to the brain, and where two things don't touch, there's going to be a hole. So you can say, what function is there that gives me the smoothest coverage in the sense I just said when you cover with some noise in the lattice? And the answer is a Gaussian.
It must be the adjacent ganglion cells that are inhibiting each other's branching.
Yeah. But just in general, that's true. It doesn't matter what it is. These are things called. Okay, you put a point of light in the environment, and you see if a cell fires or how much it fires. That's called that cell's receptive field. You can define a receptive field for any visual cell. It doesn't matter where it is, be in the cortex or any place else. What you can show is that there are two functions in the world that are smoothest, cover the smoothest. One of them is a Gaussian, and the other is something called a Gabor function. And the Gabor function is a Gaussian that is elongated in one direction and modulated perpendicular to its long direction by a sine or a cosine. And those are the two functions that give you the smoothest coverage. You can show that. And the only two receptive fields that people have seen are Gaussians and Gabors. So it may be that you want to have this so that you get this smooth coverage. And there's a third reason, and that is that the function for a given that has a given size, size measured like we did here with standard deviations, that maximizes the entropy of the distribution of synapses so it's as smooth as possible given what you've gotten is a Gaussian. So there are reasons why you might want a Gaussian, But there are times when you wouldn't want a Gaussian. So for a leaf venation pattern, because it's giving, or a wing vane pattern is giving mechanical properties, then you'd want it to be uniform because you want it to be equally stiff every place or something.
Too much because adjacent ganglion cells are inhibiting each other to get that pattern.
If they inhibit each other, if they inhibit growing, they do inhibit growing. That's part of the model. That's those tubes around, and so when this ganglion cell can't touch that one.
It's only going to be a fairly local effect. It's not going to be penetrating very far into the other ganglions.
They do
center of activity. Do they? Do the tentacle from this ganglion go like a long way into this?
No, the arbors are truncated at 2 standard deviations, and the cell bodies are 3 standard deviations apart. So they overlap by 1 standard deviation.
This is being cancelled obsessed with these lambdas. See, your lambda is as it was a product of 3, basically like a volume of each.
Yes, it's a volume of each, right?
So now, if you look at just one snapshot of one particular mammal, these lambdas would be different for different arbors, right?
Yes.
And then across mammals or across different organisms, they might be further different. I was curious, what kind of things do you find in terms of volumes and the distributions and things like that?
So they are, what you tend to have is, instead of looking at the lambdas individually, for example, for 2D arbors, you could look at the ratio of the lambdas. So that would be like like an aspect ratio of an ellipse. Okay. It turns out that those are distributed kind of Gaussianly. They're not different classes of them. In other words, they're not a bunch of oblong ones and a bunch of circular ones, and they come in 2 categories. They're pretty evenly distributed, and there's no difference between axons and dendrites, and there's no difference between cells, between species. Now, that's not so good an answer, because what we did is we just took all the cells in the database and we'd lump them all together. And if you started splitting cells up and doing it in a smarter way, then you might see something. But at least at the level which we've done it so far, which is just to take everything and say and break it down according to laboratory or according to excitatory or inhibitory or things categories we know, or species, there's no difference.
I mean, and also particularly if you're thinking of it as a space filling, you might see correlations between lambdas. So if you have one ball, then around that ball, if you have to really make uniform space filling, you might start seeing correlations of these lambda x and y in terms of their shapes.
You
mentioned in the beginning that there are different genes expressed in different cortical areas. So if there's no statistical, if the shape is universal and also the lambda is not like different in different areas, then what is controlled by the genes?
If you ask people, is there life on Mars? Nobody knows, right? But it's not as if people have no opinion. Some people say, yeah, I don't care. But other people say, I think there is. I really want there to be. They don't say I want there to be, but they accept the evidence for life on Mars more easily than say I would. I actually don't care. Either way, it's fine with me. Okay, there's a similar thing for the cortex, and that is that there are people who like to believe that every area has its own totally distinct cortical circuit, and maybe 10. There are other people who like to say, no, the cortex has the same circuit every place. What happens is that it may get tweaked a little bit to to do his computations slightly different one place or another, that you have different distributions of inputs coming in, and you take the information and put it different places, but it's just one basic circuit. It's called the canonical circuit. Okay, so so depending on how you believe these things, you might believe that the genes are what tell the circuits what to do. On the other hand, you might believe that the different genes are just used to tell other areas whether to send information there or not, what information they receive from other areas, how it gets distributed, and where it goes to. So it may be that there's one circuit, and you don't actually change the circuit. The elements are all the same in there that you make it out of. The circuits are all basically the same. The only thing that gets changed is what the inputs are and what the outputs are. So.
You see no difference between visual and auditory cortex.
Well, okay. So if you count, if you take a square millimeter of cortical surface and you count all of the cells going underneath it, for a mouse, our cortex is about 3 times thicker than a mouse's cortex. A mouse's cortex is our cortex overall, the whole brain is 1,000 times more than a mouse, and it's 3 times thicker. If you take all of the cells underneath 1 millimeter, and different cortical areas have different thicknesses, if you take all the cells and count them underneath 1 square millimeter of cortex, you get 100,000. You get 100,000 whether it's a mouse or a human. You get 100,000 whether it's an area in the temporal lobe or a motor area. It's always 100,000. There's an exception to that, and the exception to that is primate visual cortex. And primate visual cortex has 2.5 times more neurons than any other cortical area. It has 250,000 underneath a square millimeter. And so there's something different about visual cortex. It's sort of as if you took 2 cortices and you squished them together or something. I don't know how to think about it. Yeah, so. But anyway, all the other areas are kind of uniform. And the result I just told you is one that some people hate and some people love.
I just have one tiny question, but somehow when I wrote down my notes, mu k of x and sigma x, I got the same. What were the definitions of these two?
Oh, mu k is just the normalized kth moment.
Okay.
And sigma is the just the normalized second moment. Just to keep, you know, sigma is usually the second moment.
Okay, it's the second moment. Okay,
yeah. That's right. It's the normalized second.
When you plot it for sigma.
Yeah.
Okay.
But in the previous question, you also said there were maybe delicate histological differences between the different areas.
Yes, there are.
Could those correspond to different gene expression patterns?
They probably are part of that. Yeah. And so, for example, every area of the cortex has a certain size. There's a transcription factor, EMX2, that makes a gradient that's high in the back and low in the front. If you make that gradient steeper, the cortical areas in the back of the brain get bigger, and the ones in the front of the brain get smaller. And if you make that gradient shallower, the ones in the front get bigger, and the ones in the back get smaller. So there are all these gradients and things like that, and so part of these gene differences may not be discrete for areas. All the stuff we're looking at is, but there are a lot of things that aren't. There are a lot of these gradient things around, and I have no idea why they're there for. I don't think anybody does.
Ingredients in the gene expression?
The gene expression, you don't know what they're all for, but you know what some of them are certainly for. Because, for example, there are these efferent gradients that tell axons how far to grow and to stop. And but the other area specific markers, because some of them are quite definite. Those you don't know what they're good for. I don't know what they're good for. Okay, thank you guys.
Again, make your spot.